All right, welcome to class today. Glad to have you with us. We're going to start by reviewing the online quiz. And as we do that, it's quickly going to become evident that there's a bit of thing we need to do, so we'll do a little lesson on a bit here of the first two questions. I'm going to skip the first two questions and come back to them because I want to talk some more about them later. Most of the other questions on the quiz we were doing reasonably well on. There was a little confusion about the relative lengths of sequences and sets. Some people thought they were the same length and some people thought they were different. The important thing to remember to understand why there are fewer of these is that order doesn't matter. So if you think, for example, just of this, if we just had a much smaller example set, if I had a set of just two values instead, for the digits, I could put any of the 10 digits first and any of the 10 digits second to get a total of 100 values for sequences. But for the sets, there is no first and second. And so all of those that had the first number smaller than the second would sort of be the same as those that had the first number larger than the second. So we'd have some duplicates we'd have to remove. We'll sort of talk some more about how we remove duplicates and so forth today. We were doing quite well in understanding how the cardinality of unions and cross products and so forth worked. I think across the board, we were up at least in the 85 percentile. When we started dealing with these sets A and C have an empty intersection, a non-empty intersection, so there's some value they both have, okay? When there's some value they both have, the union is going to have less than the sum of the two values because that duplicated element is not going to be twice in the union, which is why this is less than. However, that doesn't change anything for the cross product because cross product results in a set of sequences and we don't care what the entries of the sequences are, their order, they allow duplicates and so forth. So just like this was the correct answer if there weren't duplicates, it's also the correct answer if there are duplicates in those two sets, shared elements between them, because the result of this is a set of pairs and the two elements of the pairs having the same value doesn't remove them from the list, from the set. And we did reasonably well here as well when we are thinking about different ways of creating passwords. Let's just briefly review why these are the right answers. So here we say we're going to take the 26 lowercase letters and 10 ASCII digits. So because we can pick a digit or a letter, or means plus, because we need to take 8 of them, we have to the 8th power, which is the correct answer. So if we don't allow doubled characters, that first thing can still come from anything, but each of the others can come from anything except the one right before it, which is why we have the one from anything and one from anything but one. When we are not allowing any repetitions, we have this formula we talked about some in class last time, right? We can think about all of the possible orderings of these values divided by all of the orderings of the one we pick. We'll talk some more about how this math makes sense today in case it didn't for you. But we did go there and most people were there doing just fine. When you're writing out things in full, I should note here that my answers are simpler than the set of things I actually accepted. So there are other accepted answers that have this in the other order, for example, for this. Remember that set 3 to the 2 is going to be the pair 3, 3. And then this, so I'm going to have a pair 3, 3 followed by a 1 or a 2. And so I have 3 possible values. And when we are doing powers and products, we don't include internal parentheses. I believe the key accepted the case where we had parentheses around the 3, 3. If it didn't, I will go and add that after class. So technically, we could think of this as being a set of pairs where the first entry of the pair is a pair. However, the normal way of dealing with multiple powers and products in a row is to flatten them all together into a single sequence. And so this would be the more canonical way of writing it, although putting that first entry as a pair is sometimes done. As I'm looking at this, I'm thinking I may have forgotten to put that in the key, but I can do that after class. So the question is it fine if we have parentheses around the first pair? It should be. If you don't currently have points for that, I will change that after class. Actually, let me make a note of that so I don't forget to do that. Okay. And these others, we were doing just fine, right? Any AB followed by any BC, so ABAB, BCBC, ABBC, and BCAB were all fine there. We also have here the common subsequence and common substring. Substring, we are virtually all getting it fine, realizing that day was the longest consecutive sequence of characters here in both. Just understand why there's an R here. Both of these have an R before day. They have different other elements in them, but we're finding the longest sequence, subsequence. Subsequence does not need to be contiguous. So those ones we were dealing generally fine with, and now we're going to come back to the first two questions, because we need to say some more about this. We did reasonably well on this first one as a whole, right? Red turtles only mate with yellow turtles, okay? So we need a pair of turtles because we need to be able to talk about mating. We're looking at all of those pairs. All of those had that, okay? And so it is fine to say either that if the turtles mate and the first one was red, then they're yellow, or that if the first one was red and they mate, then they're yellow. Both of those correctly give across the idea that if they're mating and red, then the other one is yellow. It is not correct to say, for example, the most common incorrect answer was that if I find a red turtle and I find another turtle that's yellow, then they're mating. That would formalize the notion that all pairs of red and yellow turtles mate. And it is not the case that all pairs of red and yellow turtles mate according to what we say. We say red turtles only mate with yellow turtles, not that every red turtle mates with every yellow turtle, which is why this is incorrect. And most of the others are some variation on that concept. Just sort of the third kind that we have is if they're mating and it's yellow, then it's red. That doesn't work. That again, that says that yellow turtles only mate with red turtles. We wanted red turtles to only mate with yellow. Before we move on to question two, any other questions or things you'd like me to say more about question one? All right. Question two. I put this question on the quiz because I was beginning to postulate, based on the bad answers, we were getting some other questions, that this concept may not have come out correctly. And it turns out the results made sense here. That we didn't really understand the alternating quantifiers of exists and for all. So I'm gonna go talk a little about that, then we'll come back to this quiz question and talk about how that works. Okay, let me try giving you some other ways besides the ways we've already talked about of thinking about exists and for all. So let's start over here with exists. Exists is an optimistic claim. If anything is true, then true is the result of the whole. So we could think of it as happening in some kind of code like this. Some pseudocode here, right? But I look at every possible x, and if any of them, p of x, was true, then the answer is true. And only if I can get through all of them without finding a true do I get a false. And for all, it's pessimistic. If I ever find something that makes it false, then I'm going to say false is the answer. Otherwise, I'm going to say true is the answer. Okay. Now, my general read is we have a pretty decent working understanding of exists and for all. Part of the reason I want to show them in code is to show what the code would look like if we combined them, to try to think of another way of thinking about them. So if I say for exists for all, the order here matters. Exists for all exists are not the same. And here is a couple of different ways of thinking about how they're not the same. This innermost thing is the pessimistic thing. But I have an optimistic view of pessimists. This means I'm saying some pessimist is satisfied. Somewhere out there in the world, there is some pessimist that's satisfied, then this whole statement is satisfied. Or in code, I'm gonna loop through everything, and I'm gonna loop through everything again because I have two quantifiers. The inner thing is being pessimistic. If I ever find something false, then the inner for all is going to say false. The outer thing is optimistic. So if ever I can make it through the inner thing without turning false, then the answer is going to be true. Okay. Now, when I swap the order, I swap the order of the code, I swap the order of the optimist-pessimist. So this one is saying, I want to look at every single optimist in existence. If they're all satisfied, then I'm satisfied. Or another way of thinking about it is my inner loop is optimistic. My inner loop is checking for, can I satisfy this for anything? And if ever that is false, if I ever find something that I can't satisfy for everything, then the whole thing is going to be false. Only if all of the optimists are satisfied, is the pessimist on the outside satisfied. So these two behaviors are different. And it strikes me that we don't seem to be having a majority of the class understanding that difference in practice. Okay, so let's see if we can apply that here to this statement. There exists an X such that for all R, A, R of Y implies M of YX. Okay, so we have our inner thing is our pessimist. Okay, so for our inner thing to be satisfied, it must be the case that this is always true for the picked X. In other words, I always either have to not be red or I have to mate, because that's the meaning of this it implies. But I only need that whole thing to be true for one special X. I don't need it to be true for every X that exists. I just need it to be true for one special X. So the first way we can look at this is there's a red turtle there's a turtle every red turtle mates with. Okay, so if I say every red turtle mates with something, that would mean that it's true for everything, that if it's red, we mate with it. Okay, which is a fine way, but I only need one of those turtles. There just needs to be some such turtle that every red turtle mates with. I don't need every red turtle to mate with it. And so this is a correct expression of this expression. If I say instead, we'll come back to B. There's an ambiguity in B. If I say instead that red turtles only mate with one special turtle, that doesn't specify what I'm talking about here. This is making a universal claim about turtles that they only mate with this one special turtle. And that's not what implies means here, right? I am saying that all red turtles mate with this turtle, but I'm not saying that's the only thing they mate with. I'm only just saying that being red implies you do mate with the special turtle. So the only here makes that false, because it would suggest the implication were to point the other direction as opposed to the direction it actually points. This third one, or fourth one, I guess, option D here, no matter how many red turtles you find, there's always a turtle they've all mated with. Okay, this also works. Okay, we can think of this as being a pessimistic claim. No matter how many you find, there's always. Okay, so I have this for all. There's always a turtle that all of the red turtles have mated with. You find a red turtle, it's mated with it. But there only has to be one such turtle, right? So they all have to have mated with it, but there only needs to be one such turtle. Exists a turtle that all of them have mated with. So that is a correct answer. However, if I say no matter which red turtle you care to look at, somewhere there's a turtle it's mated with, that is not sufficiently pessimistic. I don't need there to be a turtle each of them look at. I need there to be a turtle that all of them have looked at. So the fact that there's a turtle that each one of them has mated with is not giving me the for all, not giving me the exists for all that I'm looking for. It's more like a for all exists. Okay. Doesn't D imply that every red turtle is mated with one singular red common turtle? That is correct. D implies there is one singular turtle they have all mated with, which is also what this claims. This claims that I can optimistically find the best turtle in existence, but once I find it, all of the red turtles have mated with it. There is one singular red turtle that all of them have mated with. Okay, so why is E incorrect? This one is saying I get to look for the turtles first. This is doing the optimist before pessimist before the optimist. Saying, find me a turtle, I'll find you what it's mated with. There's a turtle each of those turtles has mated with. I'm not saying that all of them have mated with the same one, and this is claiming that all of them have mated with the same one. Isn't E implied by D? No, absolutely, it isn't. Isn't E implied by D? Yes, sorry. E is implied by D. D is a stronger claim than E. But D is the claim that is given here, not E. Can we repeat how we'd formalize C? Red turtles only mate with one special turtle. This is the other kind of implication. Okay? This is saying that that if you look at all of the mates of a turtle, if the turtle was red, they're all going, there's only going to be one of them. This is a sort of an exists unique. Okay? So this would imply that if you can find a red turtle that is mated with something, then you've always looked at the same end result. So it's a much more complicated expression because we have this only, but the core idea here is that we're sort of saying that if you've mated with them, it implies that it is that particular turtle. Isn't E still true based on the logic? Yes, E is implied by the logic, but it is not a correct interpretation of the logic. It's a much more restricted thing. It's a much more limited statement. This statement says there's one turtle that everything is mated with. E only says that everybody has a mate. It doesn't say they all have the same mate, which this one does claim. Yes, the comment that it's technically true but not specific enough is correct, right? We're asking for an interpretation, not just a true statement. All right, any other questions here about question two? Perhaps a takeaway from this, hopefully a couple of takeaways. First, when you see multiple quantifiers of different kinds, it is likely your intuition will be a little rusty. Okay, so give it a second look. If you see multiple things of different kinds, give it a second look. I'll get to question B, thank you for that comment. But so give it a second look and a couple of other ways of thinking about it, right? The optimist pessimist might work for some of you, the code might work for some of you, different ways of thinking about it. But do remember that we do the innermost one first, and then the outermost one gets to sort of control how it works, different ways of thinking about that, but that kind of idea will work. Why did I drop B from the quiz? Because of an ambiguity in the word sum. Okay? If I interpret sum as meaning there is one and only one for all time, there is the some special turtle that every red turtle mates with, and this is a correct version. If I interpret it as being the sort of vague statement that there is a turtle, but it could be a different turtle each time, then this is an incorrect statement. And the way English works, saying every red turtle mates with some turtle, doesn't tell me which kind of some we meant. And so this could be interpreted as true, could be interpreted as false, depending how you interpret the word some, which is why I dropped it from the quiz. For question two, it never specified what set X and Y were a part of. That is absolutely true. Yes, I assumed the domain of turtles. And I suppose that could theoretically mean that you thought that none of them were correct because I wasn't talking about turtles. I will go and look at that after the fact and see if there's a reasonable thing to do if that is exactly what you answered. Other questions? Okay. I'll keep asking questions along these lines, and hopefully we'll get to the point where we're all getting them correct. And at this point, I'm beginning to think that I may have mistaught it earlier when we're having 50% of the class not understanding it. So if we do get to the point where people are getting it correct on the quizzes, I may use those to replace earlier quizzes instead of waiting to the final to do that. We'll see if we can get there. All right. So that's what I wanted to say about the quiz. Let me also just briefly peek at our schedule. So we have 4 weeks of class, counting this week left. Just as a reminder slash restatement in case you didn't see it, the last day of class, we will have an in-class quiz that will be you can take probably one, maybe two of the topics, and it will replace the same way the final exam will. The final exam will let you take up to all four topics individually to replace something. So we have those coming up. Part of the reason I'm going to limit what you can do here is I want to have few enough answers that I can grade things so you know how you did by the time you get to the final. We will spend the 24th, the last class before that on review, and probably the link there may be an old link. I'll go back and look at that. But we have four main more topics we need to cover. I will likely reorder these a little bit. We have a question, is in-class quiz 12 optional along with the final? Absolutely, yep. So it will be sort of a pre-chance to do a little bit of the kind of thing we're doing in the final, chance to make up some work or fix something you did poorly. If you're doing great going into it, there will be no need there. I also commented earlier, I may review and adjust the grade boundaries of mastery to make more masteries than we currently have. And again, as I said before, but just as a reminder, I plan to do that once I have two of the online in-class quizzes graded so I can sort of see how that's changing scores. So that will happen after Tuesday the 7th of April is when I'll review that and possibly bump some of your mastery levels up. So in-class quiz is basically two sections of the final. Yes, that's the plan. One or two, I will see if I have enough TA staff and so on to grade two. It may just be you pick one. All four will be available, but you'll pick one or two, depending on how many I have available to grade. And then we'll get them all graded and back to you no later than Wednesday, so that when you come in class to the final on Friday, you will understand what you've missed. It will replace that entire topic. So it will replace in-class and out-of-class portions on that quiz. If you replace a replacement quiz, is your grade lower? That is the plan. I want to know what you know at the end of the class. So if it looks like you knew less than I thought you did, then your grade will go down. However, if that happens, I will also enter a conversation with you to figure out why that happened. So the default policy is, yes, it's a straight replacement, not a replace if better. But if it turns out to be worse, that won't be the last word you hear. There will also be a conversation to see if we can figure out why. So it's about a category, not a specific quiz. That is correct, right? So there's the four category topics. So there'll be four parts to both in-class quiz 12 and the final exam, of which you can take a subset. In-class quiz 12, the subset will be limited in size by the number we can grade. Finally, you can take as many or a few as you want, and then replace those topics rather than specific earlier assignments. Open note, yep. It'll be open note, just like we've been doing for our other, for Friday's one, I guess, because I don't believe in trying to tell you your notes are sitting right there, but you can't touch them. That feels like an awkward temptation. Other questions? Can we still take the four categories of the final exam if we feel we didn't do well in the class exam? Yes, you can. That's right. Yes. The way I'm thinking about it is in-class quiz 12 is a chance to make up something that you sort of missed, and then final exam is a second chance to show me what you know, but I'm not going to try to enforce that in any way. You could take them both. You could take them neither, however you want to do that. Will quiz 12 be graded before the final? It will. And that's why I'm going to limit how much you do in in-class quiz 12 so that I have time to do that. Okay. Let's go and talk about permutations and continue our conversation from last Friday about counting. Will there be a time limit? Yes, there will. Because I'm always going to time limit these things so that you aren't tempted to ask everybody you know. We'll talk some more about that as we come closer. All right, let's talk about counting again. As we're talking about counting, okay, we talked last time about or means plus and means times, okay? And so if I'm counting how many choices I have, if I can choose one thing or another thing, I add up those things in my count. If I can choose one thing and make another choice, then I multiply the number of choices available for those two things. Okay. We're going to see a few other general rules and then see how we can apply them to count some sorts of things that you might actually want to count when we're analyzing the complexity of various problems. If we decide that some things are indistinguishable, then we're going to divide. Okay, and so let's just sort of start with a simple example here. Okay, let's think of we want to have a set of two digits. One way of thinking about this is that I need to have a set, x, y, where both x and y are digits. So I've got 10 choices here and 10 choices here. Because that's an and, I would expect 100. However, some of those are indistinguishable. In particular, if I pick the same number twice, the order here doesn't matter. Okay? And so I need to sort of divide by those indistinguishable situations. All of those times when I pick the same number twice. And so I'm going to either divide or subtract, depending on whether I can count all of them, or I'm counting one per each combination. Okay. So one way of thinking about this is for every selection of X I pick, there is one selection of Y that didn't work. And so I can divide, so I can say there's going to be a total of 10 options that are not going to work. There's the 0, 0, the 1, 1, the 2, 2, and so forth. Are we including 0 such as 0, 0? We're not actually asking for numbers, I'm asking for sets. Okay, so the question is 0, 3, a two-digit number. If I were asking about numbers, that'd be a great question, but I'm saying instead set. So it certainly is the case that 0, 3 is a fine set. But I also have 3, 0, okay? So one thing I can do is I can subtract out the 0, 0 cases, okay? Because those don't make much sense. The other thing, though, I'm sort of interested in, is the fact that these two are the same. Pick me any set and I can show you another set that looks the same. And so I could say, well, I really only have half that many sets. 0, 3, and 3, 0, they're the same as each other. And so I'm gonna say I have indistinguishable. These two are indistinguishable. And these ones are sort of malformed. Okay, and so I want to sort of subtract out the malformed sets, of which there are 10, and note the indistinguishability of the others with division, to end up with how many sets I could actually have. We'll see some other ways of computing this a little bit later in class, okay? But this is the basic concept of how I would go about trying to say some things are indistinguishable. So if I have pairs that I can't tell apart, I'm dividing by two. Some things don't exist, so I have some malformed ones. Which happens first is a little bit tricky, and she will show some fancier cases. Yes, the question is, which one do you do first, right? So to understand which one I do first, I have to decide, am I subtracting out 10 cases of the distinguishable or 10 cases of the indistinguishable? In this particular instance, I said there are 10 pairs like this. And so I want to subtract out just those 10. We're thinking about all the possible ways that I could have 0, 0 or 0, different ways of doing that than I might put it in the numerator. We'll show some more general rules for this particular case here in a moment. But here, I have 10 of these cases that I don't want to think about, and half of the remaining cases I don't want to think about. Okay, and so we could say it was this, we could say it was this, and then to figure out which one it is, we'd have to think more closely, right? These are clearly not the same, so which one is it? Which one is the right answer? Okay, and so we can get a little bit tricky when we're trying to think about this. We will come back to this point. You know what? We should probably just go through it right now rather than leaving it undecided. Okay, so which one do we want to do? One way we can sort of think about this, I'll show you a sort of a work by example tool, and then we'll also talk about the general principle. Imagine instead of digits, I just had two things, right? So suppose I wanted 0 and 1 as my two sets. And then I could try to enumerate all of those that this would count, right? I could try to look at all of these that I could ever get and decide how many of them I really want. Right, my math here would say, okay, I have 4, half of them are indistinguishable, and half of them are special. That would be 0. That is not the right answer. I could say I have 4, half of them are special, half of them are indistinguishable. That would be 1. That is also not, that is the right answer, right? I have exactly 1 of those sets of 2 digits. And so using this sort of analogy with small enough things you can enumerate it can be a useful skill as we're going along. And the, by parallelism, I would expect that to be the right thing if I have 10 values. Okay. The principle here that I want to think about as I'm going through here is, and what is the result of dividing by 2 here? It is removing duplicated pairs, but I'm not going to have duplicates of those. I am going to have duplicates of those, right? Because if I say I can have 10 things from this and 10 things from that, then I'm going to have more of those than I want. And so I'm going to want to make sure that I deal with them in the right order. This is all of them, remove out the 10 that don't matter, and then the remainder I have doubles of. And so I want to do it in the order of remove these that didn't have doubles, then divide out the doubles, rather than remove the doubles and then subtract out twice as many as I should have. That probably didn't make sense to some of you. Sorry, I didn't say it very clearly. Let me try restating it and then also reiterate the example point, and I'll point out some more general rules. Okay, so as I'm going through this process, what I want to think of is the order I want to do things in. This is removing doubles. This is removing the special sets. The special sets don't exist in double. So I want to remove the special sets before I remove doubles, because there aren't doubled special sets. And so I want to do first the thing that where the specials exist before I do second, removing the doubles. And I can also verify this by the smaller example. Thoughts, comments, questions about this idea of indistinguishability, which is division, and then not part, which is subtraction. Okay. Oh, what are special sets, malformed ones? Yeah, so the rule here is I set a set of 2 digits, and then the rule I gave me more than the set of 2 digits. It gave me some sets of just 1 digit. Right, the set 0, 0 is a set of 1 digit. So I removed those ones that my rule gave me that it shouldn't have given me, which is why I call them special. We can think of them as malformed. We can think of them as not belonging. Think of them as an error in my generation technique, any of those work. Are we counting the number of sets here? Yes, the number of sets. Okay. So, with these tools, or and indistinguishable and I shouldn't have generated, okay, we're also going to talk about a few, 2 particular general rules that we want to know. One of them we've actually seen before, but the number of subsets of set A is equal to the cardinality of the power set of A is equal to 2 to the A. That's the number of subsets that exist. And we've seen this before, but it's just worth reiterating as we're thinking about counting things. If you're counting subsets, you should know this. We will see subsets of a particular size here in a moment has a different formula. But to get to that, we're going to have the number of permutations of a sequence S is equal to the length of S factorial. Permutation here, you can think of as being a shuffling or a reordering, okay? So for example, the permutations of the sequence 1, 2, 3 are all of the reorderings of 1, 2, 3 I can make. So I have 1, 2, 3, I have 1, 3, 2, I have 2, 1, 3, I have 2, 3, 1, I have 3, 1, 2, and I have 3, 2, 1. There are 6 such permutations, okay? And these are those permutations. And 6 is the length of S, 3, factorial, which is to say 3 times 2 times 1, which is 6, which is the number I just generated, okay? And there's various ways of understanding why this would be the case, right? I can pick any of the 3 entries for my first value in my permutation, 1, 2, or 3. But for each of those I pick, there are only two options remaining for the second value. So if I picked a one, I only have two or three to pick in the second spot. And then I only have one to pick in the last spot for each of those first two spots I might have picked. And so I have to pick a first spot and a second spot and a third spot. Three and two and one, six. Okay, and this will work for as many spots as I have. So I have this number of permutations is factorial. Given this, we can start to use our pieces to derive and understand some other things. So how about the number of k element subsets of an n element set? How can I count the number of k element subsets? We'll get to a final form here that is probably worth memorizing because it's going to show up fairly often in the real world and in analyzing code and so forth. But let's build it out of the pieces we know, okay? Here is how I'm going to generate a k element subset. I'm going to shuffle the whole set as a sequence. So I'm going to think of all of the permutations that could exist. Shuffle it out, and then I'm going to split it into a k and an n minus k set. There's only one, and I'm going to split it right at the kth element, so there's only one of these things to do. I'm going to do this, and I'm going to do that. Split it up, okay? So one way to think of this, if I were thinking my original set was set 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, and let's suppose I wanted a two element set, then I would shuffle it. Maybe I get 2, 3, 1, 4, 5, and then I would split it. So I have a 2 and a 3 element set, okay? And then I need to essentially unshuffle because I want sets. So I can unshuffle the k-element set. All of the shufflings of the k-element set are indistinguishable from each other. So here I'm going to divide by, because I am saying all of the shufflings here are indistinguishable, I'm going to divide by k factorial, all of the ways of shuffling that first set. I'm also going to unshuffle the n minus k set, because all of the orderings of this are indistinguishable. And so I'm going to say I have n minus k factorial. I'm also dividing by that. And that is going to be my end result of all of the two element sets I can get. Okay, all of the two element sets are all of the things that could be in the front here. And so that is going to end up being n factorial over k factorial n minus k factorial. All of the orderings of it I could find. Unshuffle the first k, unshuffle the second k, and that will end up with distinct k element subsets I could possibly have. This equation is so common and popular, it has special syntax, the choose syntax. This is read n choose k. Okay. Is exclamation point in the right split? Yes, I need to unshuffle both sides. The reason I need to unshuffle both sides is how I shuffled the left side and the right side, neither of those shufflings were actually meaningful in counting subsets, right? If I don't unshuffle the right side, then I'm going to say there's more subsets on the left side than there really are, because I'm going to take all of the different ways I could have shuffled the right side to get there. Oh yes, shouldn't the exclamation point be outside? Yes, it should, thank you. That was my bad. All right. So in choose k, all of the k element subsets that can be found in an n element set is found by the factorial of n divided by factorial of n minus k. And this shows up frequently in many different counting things. So can I go over this from the beginning again? Absolutely. All right. I want to find a k element subset. The way I'm going to do this is shuffle the set grab the first K elements, and then unshuffle to get them in sort of canonical order so I won't get multiple versions of the set. So how many ways can I shuffle it? N factorial ways I can shuffle it. How many ways can I split up the first K things? Well, there's only one of those. How many extra countings did I have because of permutations of the first set? K factorial. How many extra countings did I have of this because of this permutations of the second set? N minus K factorial. So I'm going to divide by those two. So I end up with N factorial over K factorial, N minus K factorial. All of the orderings that could exist divided by the orderings of the first set, divided by the set I picked, divided by the orderings of the set I didn't pick. What is K? It's just the number of elements I wanted out of my set. I can pick it at any number. Over here, this K I picked was 2 for my little example here. But I can pick any K and any N as long as K is smaller than N. Okay. So this gives us 3 special things that are useful to think about. The number of all subsets is 2 to the number of things. The number of permutations is factorial. The number of K element subsets is going to be N choose K. These three principles we'll deal with this in many circumstances. So can I go a full small scale on an example? That's a good idea. All right, let's say I wanted let's do the same thing here. Okay, so I say I want a 2 element subset of this 5 element set. How will I generate each of these things? I'm going to shuffle it. I'm going to split out the first bit, and so I'm going to end up with a set 1, 4. This is an example of how I would generate one of these things. Shuffle and split. Okay, but if I count all of the shufflings and splittings, I need to make sure that I don't double count for different orderings I can have before and at the beginning. So the ways I can shuffle is 5 factorial, that is, say, 5 times 4 times 3 times 2 times 1, which is to say, 120. I just shuffled randomly. I just picked an example shuffle. I want to go through all of them to find all of the sets, yes, but I just picked one at random. Okay, and all of these I could pick, right? Each possible shuffling I could pick will give me a subset, right, as I go down. However, note that the ordering of sets doesn't matter. So I end up getting this same set for multiple reasons. In particular, if I had done 1, 4, 3, 5, 2, I would have gotten that same set. So I don't want to double count the orderings that I could have had in the beginning because they're all the same set. So I'm going to take that 5 factorial, which was all of the shufflings, and I need to divide it by 2 factorial, all of the ways that first so that the set I actually get could have been ordered, because order doesn't matter for sets. Okay, so this is 120 divided by 2. I also don't want to get multiple sets because of different orderings of the things after. Right, this is also going to give me that same set. And so I also want to remove all of the permutations of the thing at the end, 3 factorial or 6. So this process of shuffle, split, and then I need to remove the extra counts that come from the shufflings of the beginning and the end, okay? To end up deciding how many 2-element subsets of this 5-element set there actually are. And the answer here is 10, right? 2 times 6 is being divided by 120, or 120 is being divided by 2 times 6, which gives me 10. And we could try verifying that. This is a 5-element set. I should be able to verify what all of the 2-element subsets are. I have 1-2, I have 1-3, I have 1-4, I have 1-5. Those are all of the ones that contain a 1. I have 2-3, 2-4, 2-5. I have 3-4, 3-5. I have 4-5. And that's it. And there are 10 of them. Okay, which is the number we just found. Right, and if I sort of put these here for all of those. So this process, shuffle, grab the first two, and then uncount the later shufflings, is a way of thinking about where this math came from. And the math gives me the number of two element subsets that exist. Other questions about this process? Okay. 3 nice rules. In particular, the permutations and the choose will be rules we'll use a lot. All the subset shows up relatively uncommonly in code that we'll write. Shows up occasionally, but relatively uncommonly. But these others are going to show up a lot. This factorial and choose will be common ways of counting things. I probably won't get through all of this next thing, but let's start. Yeah, all right, let's think about, I want 2 integers, let's say positive integers. Let's write it this way. Let's say I want x and y both to be a subset, both to be positive integers, such that x plus y equals 4. How many pairs of positive integers add to 4? Well, we can just figure this out. 1 can be added to 3, 2 can be added to 2. I guess 3 could be added to 1, depending on whether we think x and y are distinct. So I have 2 or 3 of these. What if I were to say x plus y, let's add a z in here too, plus z equals 8. Now things get a little messier. I have 1 plus 1 plus 6. I have 1 plus 2 plus 5. I have 1 plus 3 plus 4. I have 2 plus 1 plus 5. I have 2 plus 2 plus 4, and so on. Lots of these. How could I count these? Various reasons we would want to count these kinds of things. It's fairly common in algorithms to end up with a situation where we know some property of a set of variables, but don't know the values of the individual variables. We want to know how many possible situations that could exist. So how can we count these things out? The principle we're going to use to count this kind of behavior is we're going to do an analogy, if you will. Analogy, or a unique representation. We're going to come up with some different problem that will have the same number of cases as this problem. Okay, let's start with this first one. I want 2 positive integers that add up to 4. How could I find 2 positive integers that add up to 4? Well, a different representation I could have is I could imagine having 4 numbers that are split in half. I'll represent my numbers just by circles for now. How are all of the ways I could do that? I could have these 3 ways of splitting my numbers into parts. Okay, so I could either split with 2 on each side, 1 on one side, 3 on the other, 3 on one side, 1 on the other. And similarly over here, when I think about this, I need to have 8 numbers that are going to add up together. And then I need to split them in 2 places. I can pick any 2 places to split them out, but I have to split it in two places to get my 1, 3, and 4 that sums up, okay? And so we can think about sort of this analogy of where, how many possible ways are there to pick these locations, which will turn into sequences and sets very naturally, as is discussed a little in the reading that was posted for today, but we will talk about more when we meet on Wednesday, because we are out of time. I will see you all on Wednesday.